If you go to the 18th chapter of 1 Kings, you might think, if you remember your Old Testament history, 1 Kings chapter 18, is that the chapter that has this phenomenal confrontation between the prophet Elijah and the false prophets of Baal, where the false prophets, hundreds of them, are doing their best to try to call upon Baal to do something, and he does nothing. And then Elijah has this altar, this offering, super saturated with water, and then calls upon the God of heaven, who sends fire down and just consumes that in a spectacular display of his own presence and power, indicating who is the real God. Isn't that in chapter 18? Yes, it is. And surely that's what 1 Kings 18 is chiefly known for. What is not nearly as often preached on is what is found in the first 16 verses that were read to us a little bit ago. That introduces us to a man by the name of Obadiah, who feared the Lord greatly. Now, before we talk about Obadiah, we might talk about ourselves. Could that be said of you? Could it be said of me? Would others who know you best, when they think of you now or after you're gone, would that be the defining characteristic? That they would think of you and, you know, that's a person who feared the Lord. That's a person whose priority was the God of heaven. And could they even add that qualifier, that adverb, greatly? Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. I don't know of a better thing that could be said about a man than that. If that could be truly said of us, we fear the Lord greatly. Wouldn't that be the highest of compliments? It was said about Obadiah. Now, you might think, well, Obadiah, isn't there there's a book of the Bible called Obadiah, isn't there? Yes, there is. He's one of the, what are classed as the minor prophets, one of the 12 short little books of the minor prophets. Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, and so on. But as it turns out, at least according to what I've read, there's about 12 or 13 different men in the Old Testament by the name of Obadiah. So there's a note of caution that you read in a verse, Obadiah, and then maybe you go to a different book of the Old Testament, and you see the same name, and then you know, automatically two and two together, well, same Obadiah. But not necessarily. Not necessarily. And we don't have any good reason to connect the prophet Obadiah, who gives us the book of Obadiah, we have no good reason to connect him to the Obadiah of 1 Kings chapter 18, so we won't try to make that connection, and I'll just assume that he's a completely separate person, which would make him, you know, this somewhat obscure character in the Old Testament. But one of my favorite kinds of sermons to try to develop is to find in the Bible people about whom not too much is said, and then try to say something about them that is in keeping with what we do know. Find a character that just kind of comes on the scene and then he's gone, and yet there is something to be said for his presence. And so Obadiah, I think you could say he was a man of some courage. He was definitely a man of faith. And he was in a delicate situation, as we'll see, that had the prospect of turning deadly for him. So I want to think about the first 16 verses here of the chapter. And Brad read it in one reading, but we're going to break it up into some, take a one or two verses at a time and make some comments about it as we go. And under the heading, our first point, reigning without rain. Now, the one doing the reigning is Ahab, and we'll have something to say about him. Wicked fellow that he was. He's the one reigning, and he had the bad misfortune, thanks to his own character, to be on the throne in a time of severe drought. And if we back up just one chapter to 1 Kings 17, I have this verse on the screen. It says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word.'" Elmer Kelton wrote a book about West Texas called "The Time It Never Rained." And here in Old Testament history for the kingdom of Israel, well, here's the time it never rained. And Elijah is on the throne reigning as the king, and or Ahab rather, and Elijah comes to him and says, "There's not going to be any rain." Well, we're used to going through periods of, you know, no rain, waiting for rain, wishing for rain, maybe praying for rain. And, you know, it's the ground is dry and cracked out there. And it would be good to get a nice soaking rain, wouldn't it? And maybe we think to ourselves, well, you know, September's coming, and maybe we'll get some good rain in September. And that's not too far off. But Elijah doesn't say that, you know, it's going to be a month or two, Ahab. He talks in terms of years. No rain for years, and not even dew on the ground. It doesn't take too long to get into a severe situation as regards your agricultural enterprises, the growing of food to keep people alive. Years without rain? How pleased do you think Ahab is with Elijah? Probably not very. In fact, I know, not very pleased at all. I mean, here is the man upon whom he can hang the blame for the drought that is destroying his kingdom. Ahab, what can you say about him? He married a wicked princess by the name of Jezebel. He married Jezebel, and Jezebel, had a terrible influence on him. She helped pull him in the wrong direction. Not that he needed too much coaxing, but what a team they made. What a horrible couple they were. Ahab, king of Israel, who, of all things, built a temple for Baal in the capital city of Samaria. Now, you can read about that back up a chapter before 17, in chapter 16, verses 29 and following. Let me say that again. The king of Israel built a temple to Baal in his capital city. Just horrific. The last person who should have been guilty of such a blasphemous deed. But that's who Ahab was. And he got himself into all kinds of idolatry. In fact, 1 Kings 16 verse 33 says, "Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him." He was smashing records of all the wrong kinds. And so we come to our text on the screen behind me, the first two verses of chapter 18. "After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, 'Go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth.' So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria." And remember, in the northern kingdom, the capital is Samaria. And the famine is severe in Samaria. And in the third year, just probably a rounding of the figure, the New Testament actually talks about this drought and Elijah and the prayer that he prayed. And in James 5 and verse 17, James records that the famine actually was 3 years and 6 months. So 3 years without dew, without rain, who could calculate the damage and the loss to the kingdom of Ahab? And now God comes to Elijah and says, "Go talk to that man. Do you think Ahab wants to see Elijah?" Well, in fact, he does, but not as a friend. As we'll read here in just a little bit, there's a manhunt on for Elijah. That's what Ahab thinks of Elijah. And well, do you think Elijah wants to go talk to that man? What if that were you being given that order? That might seem somewhat dangerous. But you know, Elijah, because the Lord said it, he goes. God said do it, so Elijah does it. And that's the way it's done, isn't it? And there's a lesson there for us. The Lord says do something, well, you do it. Well, what if it's dangerous? Well, the Lord said it. So you trust the Lord's will to be done, and you do it because he said do it. And because you love the Lord, and you want to fear him greatly. Now, number two. So I learned that there's some prophets stashed away in a cave because they wouldn't cave in. Verses 3 and 4. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. And when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Dicey times for prophets of the Lord. Not exactly safe environment to be a God-fearer in the kingdom of Ahab with Jezebel as the queen. And you wish you knew more about these prophets. Evidently, there were times in the history of Israel where you had quite a few men functioning in the role of prophets. These men are called prophets. So as it turns out, there's 100 of them at this time. I don't know if some of them had already succumbed to Jezebel's murderous intentions, but here's 100 that Obadiah was trying to keep alive. Which makes me think then that of all of the prophets whose names we know from the Old Testament, there must be a whole lot more prophets whose names we don't know than the ones we do. We know Elijah. We know Elisha. We know Isaiah and Jeremiah and Daniel and a host of others, but just here in this verse, well, here's 100. And I don't know any of their names, but they were evidently playing a part in providing God's word to God's people. Now, Obadiah's position here is not insignificant. He is over the household. And that would have to be the household of Ahab, wouldn't it? So you think in terms of the royal house. Here's a man who is tasked with overseeing, whatever all that meant. He's in charge of the king's house. I guess what goes on in the house? Sounds pretty important, doesn't it? Sounds like Obadiah was in a high position. He's serving in a godless regime in a kingdom that's on the decline, and yet he loves the Lord. He's serving Ahab, this wicked man who's trying to rule over God's people during a time of drought, and at the same time, he is defying Ahab's wife, Queen Jezebel, who is trying to kill the prophets, and Obadiah behind the scenes is doing what he can to try to keep them alive. Dangerous times. And so I find here's prophets who are stuffed in a cave to live for a while. And a bread and water being smuggled to them, just trying to keep them alive. I doubt Obadiah was telling about that to Ahab. I know he wasn't telling Jezebel. He's not talking about that to his boss, is he? But he's trying to be a good manager of the house, but he's trying to be a servant of the Lord. And he knows it's not right to put the prophets to death. You talk about a kind of a delicate situation to be in. It's interesting that sometimes in Scripture you'll come across, in times where the government is godless, like in Ahab's case, godless government over the Lord's own people. And then sometimes you'll find the Lord's people in God's providence rising up to prominence in the government of another nation. And that may even be more amazing. Think about Daniel. Think about Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego and how they rose to prominence, not in Israel, not in Judah, but in Babylon of all places, under initially King Nebuchadnezzar. And there they are deported from their homeland, exiled from the homeland, taken to a foreign place, and God brings them up into high places in the government. You know, the best people, who makes the best government are good people. Good people. The best people are God's people. You know, our government, how much better would it be if everyone in it were a Christian? That would be the ideal circumstance. Ideal. I'm not saying we hold our breath and that's going to happen in November. It's not. It's not by a long shot. I'm just saying if things were as they should be, everybody in the world would be a Christian. Everybody in the government would be a Christian. Everybody in the school system would be a Christian. Everybody would in the ideal world. But, do you know, what if it's just a few? What if it's just a handful? That's better than none, isn't it? And sometimes it's just a one in the right place who can do a key thing that propels the story of salvation forward. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 22 over in the New Testament, Paul says, "All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household." Don't you wish you knew more about that? Name's not given. But evidently, there were, I don't know how many, who they were, but there were saints who were close to Caesar. Whoever was the Caesar on the throne when Paul wrote that epistle. Those especially, greetings from those, the saints who are in Caesar's household. Maybe we'll get to meet them one day. What kind of influence did they have? It's not explicated for us. But I can appreciate Obadiah here. He had a faith that was alive. He had a faith that would go into action. It wasn't a faith that he was trying, you know, to just, in my mind, yes, I believe in the Lord, but I need to keep all that hidden, and I'm not going to take any kind of action that's going to put me in jeopardy. No, he had living faith. He had faith in action. He had faith that was willing to put himself at risk in order to try to keep some of God's people alive. Even if they had to go and hide out in a cave over here and live on bread and water, he risked his neck. Would you do that? Would you do that for the people of God? In Romans chapter 16, Paul said that Prisca and Aquila, they risked their necks for his life. And he was grateful for that. That's what a Christian ought to do. We haven't been called upon in our circumstance, and we hope it doesn't come to that. It's not like, let me go out and look for a way to risk my neck. That's not the point. The point for us would be that we need to cultivate the kind of heart, the kind of faith, the kind of godly character. Cultivate that inside you so that if you ever were called upon in a circumstance to take the risk, you would do it. You may go to your grave and never be called upon, but have the faith that would do the right thing, whatever the circumstance. Obadiah was that kind of a man right here. Not so his boss. Ahab, point number three, he was concerned about his horses, but he didn't care anything about holiness. Let's read verses 5 and 6. "And Ahab said to Obadiah, 'Go through the land to the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals.' So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself." Now it's interesting. Obadiah is trusted by Ahab. And Obadiah, in fact, he seems, the way this is worded, it's like he's Ahab's right-hand man. There's only two of them mentioned on this assignment: the king himself and Obadiah. Ahab trusts Obadiah. And why would he not? Just like we said, the best people are God's people. You know, the most trustworthy people are God's people. The salt of the earth. The light of the world. Who would make a better companion than a man of God? Who would make a better employee than a man of God? Someone who understands that he serves his earthly boss, but really he's doing everything under the eyes of his God above. Not the employee who is always trying to look for a way to cheat the system. You know, not the employee who's always looking for another way to get away with something, but somebody for whom honesty is a high virtue, who loves his Lord, and who will give, you know, the day's work for the day's wage. It's no wonder that Ahab trusts a man like Obadiah, and that Obadiah had been raised up to this position, to be over the household of the king. And so Ahab is interested. The famine is severe. 3 years. And it's got to take its toll. I don't know where all... they were getting water somewhere, obviously, because people were alive. Ahab's still alive. The prophets in the cave are being kept alive with water and bread. They're getting it from somewhere. But it's taking its toll. And just the free supply of water just to keep animals alive. And the king is concerned about the animals. Now, it doesn't say exactly why. Probably the best suggestion is he's interested in the animals for the sake of his military purposes. That's probably the interest, for the sake of, having an army that's got some resources, and we need to keep these horses alive. We need to go find some water for them. If we can, maybe we can find it. Well, Obadiah, you go that way, I'll go this way. Let's go find some water if we can. Maybe we can keep the horses alive. Well, if Ahab, if he were a good man, things would be going differently. If he were a good king, he'd love his people. But if he truly loved his people, he would love his God. And his chief concern wouldn't be the horses who needed water, but purity and holiness in the face of the God who made him. But that's not his interest. And evidently that never was his interest. But now the well-being of his livestock has been made an interest because of the drought. But why is there a drought? There's a drought because the king is wicked. If he hadn't been rotten in the first place, would Elijah have gone to him and had to tell him that, you know, by the word of the Lord, there's not going to be rain. There's not going to be rain. He's his own worst enemy, as is the case with sinners who get stuck in sin. Sometimes we become our own worst enemy. And he doesn't realize, he doesn't see it that way, does he? You know, he thinks Elijah is the enemy when he's not. How often has it played out in history where somebody who hates God looks at somebody who loves God and says, "You're the problem. I blame you." How often has that happened? In fact, it happens even in this chapter. Number four, let's talk about the meeting that took place before the meeting. Now, the main meeting is the one between Elijah and Ahab. And we're not really going into that. That's where our text cuts off. We didn't read the rest of the story. But that's what God said to Elijah. Go talk to Ahab. But before Elijah meets Ahab, Elijah meets Obadiah. And that's the meeting before the meeting. Verses 7 and 8, "And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, 'Is it you, my lord Elijah?' And he answered him, 'It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here.'" Now, it's quite a contrast. I don't have verse 17 on the screen behind me. But to compare what Obadiah says to Elijah when he meets him and what Ahab says to Elijah when he meets him, Obadiah says, "Is it you, my Lord, Elijah?" And, of course, Lord, lowercase L-O-R-D, a title of respect. Maybe a synonym would be master. my master. He's not calling Elijah God. He's not using the term in that way. But, you know what? Addressing him with respect. And in contrast, in verse 17, when Elijah and Ahab finally meet, and Elijah says to him, "Is it you? Is it you?" Well, it starts out the same. That's what Obadiah said, "Is it you?" Except Elijah, Ahab says, "Is it you, O troubler of Israel? Troubler of Israel." That's what you are, Elijah. You are a rotten troublemaker. I know you. I've seen you before. I've heard what you had to say. You're the one who told me that this drought was coming. And now we're into 3 years, over 3 years into it. What a contrast in the attitude that they had toward God's prophet. And so when these two men meet, Obadiah and Elijah, let's call one of them a wary man. He's concerned about his situation. He's concerned about his safety. And the other one is a wanted man, and that's Elijah. As we read, excuse me, picking up in verse 9, "And he," that is Obadiah, "he said, 'How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? What in the world did I do to deserve this, Elijah? Don't you realize that your instructions, if I carry those out, are going to be the death of me? Did I commit some heinous sin to deserve this?'" Verse 10, he goes on, "As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say, 'He is not here,' he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, 'Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth, has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, 'Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will kill me.'" So I learn there is an international manhunt on for Elijah. That's what Ahab thought of him. And Ahab must have had the clout and the influence and the strength, at that point at least, in his kingdom, to reach his tentacles out into nearby nations and put the pressure on them to cough up Elijah if they had him. You know where Elijah is? No, we have no idea. Is that your final answer? Are you satisfied with that answer? You sure you want to stick with that? Are you willing to swear to that answer? Because I'm going to put you under oath to your answer. You tell me you don't know where he is. And you can just imagine that if it turned out that they were lying to him, the repercussions would be severe. Ahab was deadly serious about locating Elijah. How long had he been looking? I don't know. Maybe by the time the drought started to be severe, and it must be having been severe for a long time by now. So Ahab is on the lookout. He's got other people evidently on the lookout because he's taken oaths from them that they don't know where Elijah is. Elijah, as it turns out, is a most wanted man. I don't know if they had, you know, the equivalent of a wanted poster back then, but if they did, there'd be Elijah's name on it. Maybe an artist's rendering of what he looked like. I don't know. A most wanted man. And so Obadiah is most concerned. Because, and notice how he assumes that God is going to take care of Elijah. You know that from the explanation that Obadiah gives here. He assumes God is going to take care of his prophet. And so you're going to send me over to tell Ahab that I found you, Elijah. And while I'm gone, he's going to carry you away somewhere. The Spirit of the Lord, he's going to take you out, and I won't know where you are. God's going to take care of you. He's going to keep you safe. He's not going to make you have to come into the presence of Ahab, who's been looking everywhere for you, who probably wants to kill you, or at least imprison you. God's not going to let that happen. He's going to take you away. And so when I get back, you won't be here, and that will be the end of me, and Ahab will have me put to death. So it's interesting to me that Obadiah assumes God will care for Elijah, but he does not assume that God's going to keep him safe. And you know, he understood, as should we, that sometimes the risk is real. The risk is real. Go talk to those 100 prophets in the cave over there. The risk is real. And you remember Matthew 10:28, where Jesus in the New Testament, he would say, now don't fear those who can kill the body, but they can't kill your soul. Jesus did not say, you know, if you'll just become my disciple, there won't be anybody who could kill your body. He didn't say those kind of people are not going to be out there. He didn't say the threat will evaporate. He just said, I don't want my people to live their lives in fear of those kind of people. They can't claim your soul. Worst they can do, put your physical body to death. You know, all of our physical bodies are headed to the grave sooner or later by one means or another, aren't they? One more point, number six. Let's say this is not Elijah trying to trick Obadiah. It's not a trick, but I think you could still look at it as a test. Verses 15 and 16, and Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. So as we said, Elijah, you know, he knows that God's not going to spirit him away somewhere. And then, ha-ha, the joke's on you, Obadiah. I'm not going to be here after all. He's not trying to trick him. He's giving him assurance. He's telling him, I'm telling you, Obadiah, you can trust me. I'm serious about this. I will be here. I'm going to see the king today. You know, if I were Obadiah, you know, I could have said, well, my Lord Elijah, if you want to make this situation better and assuage my anxiety, you know, come with me. You know, maybe if I dared to grab a handful of Elijah's sleeve tightly and say, you come with me. We'll both go to the king. And then that takes, you know, the danger to Obadiah out of the picture, doesn't it? But he doesn't say that. Or Elijah, if he wanted to make Obadiah feel better about the situation, he could have volunteered, couldn't he? He could have said, now I know that you're concerned for your life here, Obadiah, so here's what, I will go with you. I'll just volunteer to go with you, and so I'll be right there, and when you report me to the king, you know, you'll have me right there. There won't be any danger to you. But it's interesting that Elijah doesn't do that, does he? Instead, what Elijah does is he gives him his word. And on the word of God's prophet, Obadiah turns around and goes to find his boss, the king of Israel. And then, you know, just as quickly as he appears on the scene, he disappears. And Obadiah, well, you know, what happened to him? What was his backstory? I don't know. What happened to him after this verse here, these 16 verses? I don't know. I don't know. I hope we meet him in glory one day and have an eternity to get to know the rest of his story. So how might we try to bring all this to a conclusion? I'll never be an Elijah. I'm not the prophet of God, that lightning rod that he was. Worker of miracles, a man who could pray to God to stop the rain and God would do it. A man who would go and confront the king. A man who would actually serve as a foreshadowing, a type of the man who would later come as the forerunner to Jesus Christ himself. John the Baptizer, he came out of the same mold as Elijah, didn't he? And now that's a whole other lesson in itself. But I'll never be the prophet Elijah. I certainly don't want to be King Ahab or anybody like him or his third cousin. I don't want to be somebody who takes wickedness to new lows. I don't want to be somebody who provokes the Lord to anger. So I'll never be Elijah. I don't want to be Ahab. But just maybe I could see some things in common with someone like Obadiah. Obscure. Anybody in here recognized on the international stage? Anybody here known across the country? Or even across the state that we live in? Probably not so much. Here we are, you know, trying to live our lives in quietness, probably in a great deal of obscurity, just doing the good thing behind the scene. Is that what Obadiah was doing? He was doing a good thing, but behind the scene, he was trying to keep the people of God alive. Sometimes, like in here in this chapter, I find he's between the rock and the hard place, where he really has to lay it on the line and take a risk, and yet he was willing to do it because he feared the Lord greatly. When you think of Obadiah here, think about somebody who he steps onto the stage for this short scene, and he helps to move the story forward just a little bit. And then he's gone. And is that not what we are all about ourselves? Here we are. And we've got our lifespan, however long or short it is. And what does God require of us but that we step onto the stage for our one scene, and to one degree or another, we help to move the story of salvation forward. Maybe not a great way, if it's just a little, as long as it's in the right direction. And I don't use that word story as in a fictitious story. I'm talking about the unfolding of God's great plan to save men in heaven eternally. That's what it's about. And I've got a role to play in that. You've got a role. There are expectations. There are things that we can do. No matter who you are, what position you occupy, there's something you can do to the glory of God. You can, like Obadiah, step onto that stage and do a little bit. And then, you know, God uses you. And then you're off the stage. Somebody else is on. And the story moves forward. Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. Let that be said of each of us. We're going to stand here in just a moment and have a song of encouragement. If we can help you, if you've not obeyed the gospel yet, if that be your need to be baptized for the remission of your sins, or if we can be of assistance, come while we stand, while we sing.